Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we have frequently turned to and who has it in abundance is our guest for this full hour. His name is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. In my experience in Washington over the past 40 years, there are few people that have contributed more tirelessly, more selflessly, and I think more impactfully than Peter Pry in a variety of capacities. He was an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency for many years, in which he studied deeply various nuclear threats to our country. He has served as a member of the Armed Services Committee staff in the House of Representatives. He is these days the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum, both of which reflect, among other things, service that he's provided to our country on congressionally mandated commissions studying the EMP threat and also the strategic nuclear posture of the United States, EMP, of course, being electromagnetic pulse. Peter Pry, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for giving us a full hour of your time to talk about some of these extraordinarily important but all too often long neglected issues. Let's talk first, Peter, if we could, about the state of our nuclear deterrent. And I've said you've served in a variety of capacities that have given you insights into it. I was really struck by a statement that the new commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, Admiral Charles Richard, made the other day, in which he really talked very frankly about concerns that he has about the condition of our deterrent and the industrial base that supports it. Give us your sense, and then we'll talk about his.
Sure. His testimony came not long after an article I had published called America Racing Toward Nuclear Obsolescence. And, you know, he and I are obviously like-minded on the fact that we are our nuclear deterrent, which is the most important part of our posture, because the nuclear deterrent overshadows everything and is the ultimate guarantor of peace in the world. And it's going obsolete on all levels. And most everybody knows that the delivery systems, the bombers, the missiles on submarines, the missile ICBMs, are old, are antiques from the Cold War. And we have plans to replace them, but it's going to take many years before they're replaced. Not until the 2030s, as a matter of fact, are our new submarines, new missiles, new ICBMs going to come online. Fewer people know that the nuclear weapons themselves are also antiques and obsolete, and that the what he means by the nuclear enterprise is beyond the nuclear weapons are the scientific laboratories and their defense industries. There are industries that used to exist that would manufacture things like enriched uranium, plutonium, tritium, all these special electronic components and other specialized components that are indispensable to making nuclear weapons. And even that is not only obsolete, but really non-existent. For example, the country, we don't have the ability to make a plutonium pits anymore. Plutonium pits are indispensable to making a nuclear weapon. They're the trigger for their nuclear weapon. And right now, our plan is to be able to restore our ability to make plutonium pits. And this is just one example. By the year 2030, 10 years from now, to make 80 plutonium pits per year. Russia today, because they never shut down their enterprise, their nuclear enterprise, can make 4,000 plutonium pits annually. That's to show you how bad, how stark the situation is. I found it even more alarming when I was looking through President's proposed budget for the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is the little-known administration responsible for modernizing our nuclear deterrent, that that there's almost $1 billion, $850 million being spent to reinvent electric capacitors that are able to be used in our nuclear weapons. That is such a fundamental and simple and necessary thing that it is like carpenters reinventing the nail, having to reinvent the nail. So we don't even have basic electronics anymore being manufactured and have to go back and relearn how to do all this.
Peter, you've put a lot on the table here. Let's parse this a bit if we can. Admiral Richards is the commander of these various nuclear assets, the intercontinental ballistic missiles that are land-based, the sea-based submarine-launched ballistic missiles, as they're known, the bomber aircraft and the various missiles that they carry, and gravity bombs. And you're saying that, taken together, these weapons, most of which, frankly, were introduced when I was in the Pentagon, if not before, are functionally approaching, if not obsolescence, perhaps even obsolete status, because they have not been modernized before now, and because they were never designed to last this long. As a practical matter, Peter Pry, what does that mean if we haven't tested them in realistic underground nuclear tests since 1992? Can we have confidence in the viability of these weapons, the platforms, as well as the, you know, nuclear arsenal, the nuclear warheads themselves?
Many senior scientists who actually have served in our so-called science-based stockpile stewardship program, including the scientists who actually invented the nuclear weapons that are in our current inventory, like Dr. John Foster, argue, no, we can't have confidence, and our confidence is going to continue to diminish. Two leading scientists who were responsible for stockpile stewardship at Los Alamos National Laboratory published an article last year warning about that very thing, that in the absence of nuclear testing, our confidence in these weapons, that they will actually work and be safe and reliable, is going downhill, you know, because they're not really the same weapons anymore. They're antiques. They're the same weapons that were manufactured 30, 40 years ago. The newest one was manufactured in 1988, but some of them, most of them, were actually manufactured and designed, manufactured in the mid-1970s and designed even earlier than that. And what they've been doing is patching up these old weapons and replacing parts. But because the defense industries that used to make the parts have gone out of business or been shut down or, you know, have been underfunded by the government and basically been closed, they've been trying to find substitute parts. They've been using substitute parts. So basically, they're an old-fashioned, it's like a car that you can't start, an antique car, and you're using modern commercial off-the-shelf technology parts to try to get the car up, but you're not allowed to start the car. In other words, to test it, to see if the thing will work.
Peter Pry, we have to pause for a break. We'll be right back with more about how this could happen to us and its implications and how it compares to what our adversaries are doing. That and much more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is the author, among other things, of Apocalypse Unknown and Blackout Wars. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We have Dr. Peter Vincent Pry in the house, virtually, that is. We are speaking with him about vitally important topics that, by and large, don't get much attention. We try to give them the attention they deserve here with regularity, but it's always a special privilege to have Peter with us to discuss in detail issues that he has spent his life wrestling with at the Central Intelligence Agency, in the House Armed Services Committee, and on several very important commissions, and now at the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. And Peter, I just wanted to see if you could expand upon something that you were talking about before the break, and that is that we have not engaged in a single test, let alone a routine and systematic underground test program with respect to our nuclear arsenal. We've been changing the antique weapons, as you call them, that make up our arsenal, and it's just staggering. I don't think one American in probably a million has a clue about how obsolete the vital capabilities you've just described are. But when you look at this, Peter, as a guy who has seriously studied these sorts of issues, the confidence that we must have in our deterrent, let alone what our adversaries must have in the viability of our deterrent for it to have a deterrent effect, is sorely lacking if we haven't actually checked out these devices. They're the most complicated pieces of equipment I believe man has ever invented. And we've been plugging and playing different pieces of gear into them. We've been changing out things like carcinogenic materials, and we just sort of hope that when we put it all together again, that it'll work if, God forbid, they're ever needed to do so. That does not seem as though it's responsible. And you're suggesting that people who have been intimately involved in the design of these weapons and their previous tests and so on are deeply concerned about that as well?
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned, Dr. John Foster, who was the person who actually designed these weapons, but he's retired now. He's not in NNSA and working in that capacity. He has warned repeatedly that the failing to test and the age of these weapons undermines their credibility and raises serious questions about whether they will be safe and reliable. And in addition to Dr. John Foster's, the many others, Lowell Wood, and these scientists who wrote the article in 2019 that I referred to. But there's probably, and these people actually have served in the science-based stockpile stewardship program. Now, how did this happen? Why are our scientists being ignored? Part of it has to do. The biggest part of it has to do with the radicalization of the Democrat Party, so that the Cold War consensus that used to exist about the U.S. maintaining a nuclear deterrent second to none is broken. And, you know, the Democrats, beginning with the Clinton administration, went far left on nuclear weapons. There are many people who were deeply anti-nuclear, were put in charge of the labs, and the Clinton administration wanted to sign on to the unratified Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So we've been unilaterally observing basically the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty for 28 years, which is why we don't test anymore. Russia has cheated on that. And, Dr. Mark Schneider, who's been on your show, you know, is senior Defense Department official, one of the smartest guys in Washington on these matters, wrote an excellent article describing the Russian cheating. And the Russians actually haven't been all that quiet about it. You can find evidence right in their own open source literature. In fact, during the Clinton years, there were press reports about the Russians cheating on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We were detecting so-called earthquakes and tremors still coming out of Novaya Zemlya, their testing ground. Or people would say, well, maybe it's a tremor or maybe it's an earthquake. But the intelligence community for a while was warning about that until the Clinton administration shut them up. And they actually had Bill Gertz tailed because he had sources in the intelligence community who were so concerned about these revelations that the Clinton administration wanted to silence them. So that was one thing.
Bill Gertz, a great reporter at the Washington Times, of course, on these sorts of matters. And Peter, let me just interrupt you for one second, because it wasn't just people in the laboratories. The Secretary of Energy, a woman by the name of Hazel O'Leary, was a driving force behind this effort to essentially coerce the nuclear laboratories into agreeing that they could go along with a non-nuclear test program to maintain what you call the stockpile stewardship, and that it would all be science-based. And the lubricant for that coercive arrangement was she was going to give them lots and lots and lots of money, as I recall. But it didn't change the fact that this became more and more, especially over time. And for heaven's sakes, this is now 20-odd years on. It became more and more guesswork, did it not? I mean, informed guesswork, perhaps. And there was other kind of testing being done. But the real sorts of absolutely authoritative testing, namely you put it down a deep hole and you light it off, not in full force, but you light it off to make sure that it all works, is just something we haven't done since 1992, for heaven's sakes.
Right. And one of the strategies that the Clinton administration pursued under Hazel Lurie, too, was basically putting the nuclear laboratories in a space where they strictly weren't weren't nuclear weapon laboratories anymore. They used to be dedicated to designing, testing nuclear weapons, but they decided to expand the agenda of the nuclear laboratories as part of the bribe, because that's what it was. The science-based stockpile stewardship program was a lot of money, and it was basically a bribe to get the labs to go along that we can certify this without nuclear testing. Although if you look at the testimony, you know, from the scientists, that wasn't really, they didn't actually say that. That's what how the Clinton administration represented what they were saying, but they were able to get away with it because the heads of the laboratories decided not to fight them publicly because they were getting so much money to do other things in addition to science-based stockpile stewardship. Today, the nuclear labs are not focused on nuclear weapons. They do things like climate change and solar energy, green energy, and things of that sort.
And inventing new commercial technologies for, you know, the sale to private sector, I guess. But Peter, when you put this all together, let's just be clear. In addition to the problems that you've identified, you have this diminution, shall we say, of the technical expertise in the labs, among other things, as a result of people simply dying off or retiring who had practical firsthand experience with these weapons designs and test programs.
Yeah, we don't have a single person who's ever designed, built, or tested a nuclear weapon working in the labs anymore. Even North Korea has got that.
Well, among others, for heaven's sakes, I think that's the problem, is that other nations have not been doing this, and I want to come back to that in a moment. But in addition, Peter Pry, would you talk a little bit about the industrial base that supports this nuclear enterprise? Apart from the labs, what's the status of the industries who have been, in the past at least, responsible for ensuring that we have viable nuclear weapon capabilities? Are they suffering similar sort of atrophying as well?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the private sector doesn't manufacture these materials, things like tritium, plutonium, enriched uranium. These are done by our laboratories that belong to the National Nuclear Security Administration, places like Oak Ridge National Laboratory, for example. And these industries have been neglected for so long, that they've basically been they've been shuttered. You know, we don't make tritium. We don't make enriched uranium anymore. We don't make plutonium anymore for the plutonium pits, and we're basically scavenging through the stockpile, you know, to take these materials from older weapons as they get dismantled, and then reusing them is one of the ways we've been keeping the antiques going. So we, in addition to, we had started off talking about how well many people know about how obsolete our delivery vehicles are. Then fewer, as you mentioned, almost very few people, I think, realize that the weapons are obsolete. And almost nobody knows that the enterprises that built the weapons that are necessary for maintaining them, these nuclear industries, are also obsolete or literally non-existent, you know, which is why, I used the example of plutonium pit production, for instance, which we can't make plutonium pits today. We can't do it. In 10 years, we have with all the money we're spending and all the effort is being made, and the person in charge of NNSA, by the way, is a person known to both of us, a friend who understands how serious these things are, Lisa Gordon Haggerty. Okay, she was part of our nuclear strategy forum, so she's doing the best she can, and the best she can do is 10 years from now, we might be able to start making 80 plutonium pits a year, 80 per year. whereas Russia's making 4,000 pits right now, today, or can make 4,000 pits annually if it wants to. I'd like to say something else about the danger of not nuclear testing, by the way, while the other side is engaged in nuclear testing. You know, because this goes not just to the physical modernity of our weapons, and it surely affects that, but also the strategic utility of the weapons. So these weapons that we have that we're depending upon, these antiques that we keep patching together, they were designed in a different time for a different strategic environment. During the Cold War, they weren't designed for our current strategic environment today. And the Russians and Chinese have weapon systems and nuclear warheads that are designed for the current strategic environment.
Peter, we have to pause. When we come back, I want to switch gears a little bit with you just to take advantage of your expertise in one other topic, and it's related to Russia and China, of course, as among others, and that is the vulnerability of our country to an electromagnetic pulse form of attack. That and much more with Peter Vincent Pry right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to this important and, I'm afraid, all too serious a conversation about the nuclear warfighting potential of our adversaries and the inadequacies, the grievous inadequacies of our own deterrent to such behavior. Peter, on top of everything that you've been talking about here, there is a whole nother category of threats that we're facing, and unfortunately it's not just from the Russians and Chinese, though they certainly are capable of it as well. Much of your career has been spent studying and trying to make sure the rest of us are aware of and taking steps to mitigate our vulnerability to a catastrophic attack upon the sort of most critical of critical infrastructures in the United States, namely our electric grid. Talk a bit about that, if you would, and where, as a practical matter, that threat stands and its implications for the rest of us.
Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran all have, in their military doctrines, all describe a revolutionary new way of warfare that could make traditional armies, air forces, and navies obsolete. And it's focused on using things like nuclear and non-nuclear EMP attack combined with cyber attack and sabotage on national electric grids. And they're usually talking about our electric grids. The Iranians are quite specific about that, as are the Russians and Chinese in their military doctrines, about attacking the U.S. electric grid because it is our technological Achilles heel. You know, if you can take down the electric grid, you're basically going to black out all of the life-sustaining critical infrastructures, communications, transportation, business and finance, and our military forces. All the electricity, or at least 99% of it, that CONUS military bases use and that is necessary for them to conduct their operations and project power, comes off that electric grid. And so with a single nuclear weapon, for example, from North Korea, if they got into a crisis or a war with us, they could win a nuclear war with a single blow by using a super EMP warhead to take out our electric grid, but also a super EMP warhead generates such powerful field strengths that even our best protected military systems are not hard enough. You know, our hardest military systems are protected only to 50,000 volts per meter, whereas a super EMP weapon could make 100 to 200,000 volts per meter. Now, President Trump deserves tremendous credit for being the first president, you know, after 20 years of warning from the EMP Commission to have issued an executive order to protect our electric grid and other critical infrastructures back in 2019. But I would urge people, I'm going to pitch my own book here. I've got a forthcoming book. It's going to be published at the end of March called The Power and the Light, The Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. Be available on Amazon.com. And it will describe how President Trump's own administration Obama holdovers and deep state bureaucrats are sabotaging that executive order and slow rolling it so that the order, which was intended to put it on a short timeline and quickly get us protected against this existential threat, especially if President Trump doesn't get reelected, for sure, we're probably not going to be protected if these people get away with this. And I name names. I know you wanted me to name names on the show before, and I was reluctant to do it. But this time I name names about the people who need to be fired. And there's only a handful of people that are standing in the way. And if President Trump reads this book, or his National Security Council does reads this book, I hope they pay attention and move these people out.
Yeah, Peter, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. My commentary today, which will run as part of this program, among other places, speaks to a decision that President Trump has made lately, it seems, to actually get rid of the people inside his administration who have been sabotaging him. You know, our favorite president, I think, Ronald Reagan, famously said, personnel is policy. And Donald Trump has suffered terribly, as you understand better than just about anybody, from the effects of having Obama holdovers and Republican establishment figures who have no interest in his agenda of America First. And what we're in need of, quite clearly, with respect to ensuring the resiliency of our electric grid and therefore our society, especially in the face of this proliferation of nuclear threats and the clear understanding on the part of all these adversaries of our vulnerabilities, that we have to have people who are prepared to help him execute that order. And I'm prayerful that that will be one of the changes that is forthcoming as a result of John McAtee's ascendancy in the White House personnel office, because it's absolutely urgently needed.
Just quickly, let me say, Frank, you know, as you know, we're talking from Canada. I've been traveling, talking to Canada, and I happened to go to a bookstore to kill time in between flights. And I picked up former Defense Secretary Mattis's book, Holding the Line. Okay. And on the inside cover of the line, Mattis boasts President Trump's own handpicked Secretary of Defense, Mad Dog Mattis. It says this, and I'm quoting because I wrote it down. One of the things Mattis did that he's taking credit for is that he slow rolled some of Trump's most controversial measures with no intention of following through, end quote. How about that? Even at the level of the Secretary of Defense, you know, in addition to the holdovers, there's just been some bad policy choices in terms of the kinds of people. Frank Gaffney should be the Secretary of Defense, not Jim Mattis.
Well, we're not holding our breath. Peter Pry, let me just ask you to engage in a sort of thought experiment here. Let's just say, for the purpose of discussion, that you were the Secretary of Defense or you were the President of the United States. What would you be doing right now to try to address what we talked about earlier, the obsolescence of our nuclear deterrent and the urgent need to reaffirm the priority given to the nuclear enterprise and to ensure that it receives the resources, human and material, that it needs to get us back to a robust deterrent posture, A, and B, to ensure that we, in fact, have a resilient electric grid?
Well, I'm not sure I could do it being merely president, because I would have to be the combination of the president, the Senate, and the House in order to do the dramatic things that would need to be done. You know, the Democrats can stop the kinds of things, and would probably stop the kinds of things that need to be done. One of the things we need to do is fire a lot of the people who are currently working in the national labs who basically don't believe in nuclear deterrence. They're not like Johnny Foster or Lowell Wood, real patriots. You know, they come out of our university systems and are very anti-nuclear, even anti-Trump. So a lot of these bureaucrats have to be fired and moved out of the way. We've got to bring in a new generation of patriotic scientists who are willing and understand and have the commitment that people like Johnny Foster and Lowell Wood used to have, and Edward Teller, you know, to make America's nuclear deterrent second to none. We would have to resume nuclear testing in a big way. One of the things I wanted to mention and squeeze into here someplace, one of the things that frightens me the most, in addition to these weapons that we know that the Russians and Chinese have, these new generation nuclear weapons, is the unknown unknowns. You know, they've been testing and experimenting for 28 years. What did they figure out? There's tremendous scientific progress they can make from that. And on the EMP Commission, one of the things I noticed and Dr. Graham noticed in reading their military scientific literature, they talk about things like super EMP weapons and X-ray weapons and mini neutron weapons, and then weapons, nuclear weapons based on new physical principles. Nuclear weapons based on new physical principles. And Dr. Graham said, what does that mean? You know, and they would never explain what that means, right?
What it almost certainly means is that there is going to be a surprise awaiting us in the event that the Russians, or Chinese for that matter, God forbid, decide that the conditions are ripe for them to use such weapons against us. Peter Pry, to the specific question of the grid, though, what would you recommend be done?
This President Trump doesn't need the Senate or the House. You know, he can order the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, you know, to change the standard for hardening against E3 EMP. That's produced by the sun. That's a natural EMP from the sun, but it's also what is produced by nuclear weapons, to 85 volts per meter, to 85 volts per meter. And it will be the law that the industry has to do this. The E1 EMP standard, we don't even have one right now. There's no standard for protecting against this kind of EMP, which is produced by nuclear and non-nuclear weapons, and it's the most dangerous kind of EMP. That should be at least 100 kilovolts per meter, so that they're under the law required to meet these standards. And I wouldn't trust the utilities to do it. I would put DHS, guided by the Department of Defense, you know, to inspect our utilities to make sure they're meeting those standards. And the utilities, I wouldn't let them do it themselves because they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing about EMP or cyber attack. I would use defense contractors. They would have to use the defense contractors who know what they're doing, who've been protecting America's military systems for 50 years from EMP. The defense contractors should go in there, make the plans, make sure the things are protected, you know, and they should be inspected annually.
Peter Pry, this is vitally important that we have such recommendations before this president, before this Congress. We have to take a short break. I want to talk with you about what the Russians and the Chinese have been up to and how that is making vastly more dangerous the posture that we now find ourselves in, and that much more urgent the need to rectify it. We'll be discussing all of that and more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking about, well, the unthinkable, I guess one might say, the necessity of maintaining effective thermonuclear weapons capabilities in order to deter the, it may seem unthinkable, idea that others could actually be preparing to use such weapons against us, to dissuade them from contemplating such an action, let alone doing it. A man who has devoted much of his professional life to figuring out these sorts of issues, monitoring them, reporting on them, warning about them, is our guest. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Dr. Pry has been telling us about the appalling state of our nuclear forces, both the weapons themselves, the sort of block obsolescence that they're experiencing now, as the commander of Strategic Command has warned that we may be approaching, if we're not actually at, the point of no return in terms of having effective nuclear capabilities. And Peter, you were just teasing at the end of the last segment the dramatic difference between our capabilities, not just with respect to plutonium pits production, but so much more relative to the Russians and for that matter, you just mentioned the Chinese. Tell us a little bit about the status of the various nuclear programs, strategic and tactical nuclear programs of Russia and China, their modernity, the degree to which they are regarded as vital enterprises of their respective states, and the danger that there's a yawning asymmetry here that could prove perilous.
Yeah, Sergei Shoigu, General Sergei Shoigu, who's the Russia's defense minister, has boasted that 80% of Russia's nuclear deterrent is modernized. And, for example, Russian officials credibly claim to have advanced third-generation nuclear weapons that are clean. That is, they produce little or no radioactive fallout, and including very low-yield tactical nuclear weapons for land, sea, and air combat. They have nuclear weapons for specialized effects like neutrons, X-rays, and gamma radiation. And they also, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, from these small, low-yield, clean nuclear weapons, they also have monster, very high-yield weapons, perhaps as high as 100 megatons, they've credibly claimed, that are designed to inflict a radioactive doomsday. Now, if you just think about the first category that I was talking about, just that one, you know, what a decisive advantage that would give them. Imagine, you know, Russia armed with, you know, selectively yield weapons. It could be very low yield, a kiloton or less. You know, that's the ability to just destroy a single aircraft carrier if you wanted. And suppose that our Navy has to go up against their Navy, and our guys have no tactical nuclear weapons, and they have these tactical nuclear weapons. Or in air combat, for example, that we end up having to face surface-to-air missiles and to penetrate their air defenses that are armed with clean, usable battlefield nuclear weapons. Or in air-to-air combat, you know, we've got a conventional high-explosive warhead on our highly sophisticated jet aircraft, and their slightly less sophisticated aircraft are armed with nuclear-armed air-to-air missiles. You know, they're tanks. You know, imagine being able to have a small tactical nuclear weapon that you could fire from a tank.
Yeah. Now, what you've said, Peter, is that these kinds of capabilities may make them usable. That Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, has actually articulated strategic doctrines which strongly suggest that he thinks nuclear warfare is eminently doable and could prove decisive for Russia, vis-a-vis the United States most especially. But just walk us through sort of the logic of what you've said here and how it could really put us in grave danger.
I'm very concerned that Vladimir Putin, the president, so-called president of Russia, dictator of Russia, might well become the Napoleon of the nuclear missile age, because the Russians have a very different attitude, in fact, a different military doctrine, official military doctrine about nuclear weapons. They don't see them as being chiefly for deterrence. They see them as usable, war-winning instruments, which is why they've been designing these technologies that are usable on the battlefield, in the theater, and intercontinentally, strategically. You know, Putin takes this so seriously, and his general staff, that unlike us, you know, he's a regular participant in nuclear military exercises involving, including in Vostok 18, which arguably was one of the largest exercises in world history that involved basically a simulated World War III, both conventional and nuclear. The general staff participates in these exercises along with Putin. Unlike us, you know, where the president is the only one who basically has what we call it a nuclear football, you know, which is a briefcase carried around by an officer to authorize the execution of forces. Putin has that, but also their chief of the general staff and their defense minister also have the capability to execute the forces. And all three of them are hardline true believers in the value of nuclear weapons, not just for deterrence and intimidation, but actual silver bullets that could give them the decisive advantage in the West in a future conflict. And Putin almost this week, almost every other day, he's been boasting about the advantage that Russia has achieved in the strategic and technological nuclear balance.
And Peter Pry, this is ominous to say the least, because whether it's true or not, whether we find it conceivable or not, in the hands of someone who has now rather repeatedly, as I understand it, actually practiced launching thermonuclear attacks against NATO or against the United States, you just can't ignore the fact that he has this doctrine, he has put in place these capabilities, he does personally participate. And I don't mean just participate as in an observer. He's the guy with his hand on the button, as I understand it. We can't persist in either sort of averting our gaze from that problem or denying that we may be inducing him to think even more aggressively because of the disparity in forces that, as you say, he is now very, very mindful of. Peter, before we run out of time, very quickly, how does what you've described in Russia compare with what the Chinese are up to in terms of their nuclear posture?
The Chinese are more of a mystery to us because for decades our focus had been on Russia and not on China as an intelligence asset. And the official line in Washington, the official view, the establishment view in the State Department and the Department of Defense, is that we're way ahead of the Chinese in the numbers of our weapons. They only have about 300 nuclear weapons, although even those of the Washington establishment is willing to concede are much more modern than ours, because they've been going gangbusters deploying new type weapons. I and a lot of other people who follow these things think that Washington has been deceived for decades about this. China has never been a part of any arms control agreement. We've never had boots on the ground to have inspectors go and look and verify that we're right about those about them having such a low number of weapons. The Russians themselves, if you look at their analysis, they credit China with having more strategic and tactical nuclear weapons than the United States, and that China is the number two nuclear power in the world. And I think that is probably true. A few years ago, we discovered that the Chinese have this thing that they call the Underground Great Wall, and it belongs to their equivalent of the strategic rocket forces, their nuclear missile forces.
And how long is it, Peter?
Thousands of kilometers. It's thousands of kilometers.
Improbable in the extreme, it seems to me, that they would have a couple hundred warheads tucked away in 1,000 miles of tunnels. I appreciate what you have done tirelessly with your various books on the subject, Apocalypse Now and Blackout Wars, and your forthcoming book, which we anxiously anticipate, Naming Names, as it does especially. I hope you'll come back to us and discuss it in the very near future. But in the meantime, thank you for your time today and your great service to our country in so many different capacities, especially that you are currently rendering on the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.